Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran, and I'm joined with my co-host, Rob Greenlee. Rob, good morning. How are you this morning?
Doing fantastic, Todd. It's great to be here again and talking about new media. It's really my whole life now, and I do it 24/7, 7 days a week. You know, we're working for kind of a startup company. You basically are all in. Definitely, it's not like we're working for a big company.
Well, welcome to the club.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and of course, on the line we have another. I am very sure, another full-time content creator as well, and that's John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire. John, welcome to the show.
Todd, I'm stoked to be here, prepared to ignite. Let's do this.
Well, I know that... Rob and I have talked about having you on, I don't know, for a while, haven't we, Rob?
Definitely.
And we're just trying to work our way through the, I guess for a better word, the luminaries to find out what they're doing in the podcasting space. And I know that most folks that you work with are very familiar, obviously, with what you do, but maybe the folks that are listening to the show don't. So why don't you just give us the 30-minute or 60-second elevator pitch.
30-minute? It sounds like he's going to be doing his own podcast.
30-second, yeah, absolutely.
I'll offer the 30-second one. So yeah, I'm John Lee Dumas, the founder and host of Entrepreneur on Fire, which is a 7-day-a-week business podcast where we interview today's most inspiring and successful entrepreneurs and share their journey. We're approaching episode 600, which we're really excited about. And every day we just release a new, fresh episode that goes over failures, aha moments, and successes of entrepreneurs in every different niche. I mean, there really isn't an entrepreneurial niche that we haven't covered. You know, all the way from knitting and gardening, all the way up to sports and entertainment. So it's definitely a show with variety, but with one consistent format and flow. So people know what they're going to get when they tune in. And we were honored in 2013 to have been awarded Best of iTunes. And it's been just a great ride, Todd.
So, you know, I've known guys have done 7-day-a-week shows. And the most they've ever lasted is about 4 years. So how are you going to...
That's a long time, Todd.
It is, and that's like the longest. That's the longest ever, and that was Andy McCaskey. He's the one that survived the longest on a 7-day-a-week show. Then he went back to 5, and then he went to 3, and then he
went to 0.
And he fell off a cliff. is what's interesting about this, and I'm probably... I don't want to betray Andy's trust, but with a 7-day show, Andy did very well for himself from a monetization standpoint. Probably people don't know it, but he was probably at the time one of the top in category. So even though the money was great, he just couldn't handle the 7-day flow. How are you gonna balance that, John?
It's definitely going to be a balance. I will say I don't have illusions of grandeur where, you know, I see myself still carrying this same torch 5-10 years from now. I kind of have this one goal, Todd, of getting to 1,000. That's my goal. You know, I'm still, you know, about 2 years away from that. So that'll put me right around Andy's time frame of that 4-year mark, which could be the burnout mark. We'll see. It could be like that infamous 4-minute mile, so to speak. But, no, that's where my focus is right now, is to continue to keep that balance. For instance, Kate and myself are leaving on Wednesday for 2 weeks in Europe, and we are completely shut off during those 2 weeks. No emails, no part in the business whatsoever. And we're able to do that because of the scheduling, Todd, because of the batching that I do. So even though my show is 7 days a week, I'm only recording episodes for Entrepreneur on Fire 1 day a week, and those are Monday. I do 8 interviews every single Monday. It's not easy. Those are long days. I'm exhausted by the end, but I can always get myself rallied up for one really exciting, enthusiastic day of interviewing, knowing that when I wake up Tuesday morning, the rest of the week is truly on my schedule, allowing me to do interviews like this, you know, even on a Saturday. So that's what's really got me this far, Todd, was really segmenting and batching and only doing Entrepreneur Fire interviews in those batches, 8 every single Monday.
Well, that kind of makes sense. You know, if I was going to do a daily show, that'd be the thing is, you have to have the right type of show to do a daily show. you know, Andy's show was a news, and it was heavily, yeah. heavily scripted. So not only did he have, you know, this review process he had to go through for 2 or 3 hours, well, a couple hours, and then he scripted it all. So, yeah. you know, he had his, and his show was only 15 minutes or so, 20 minutes. So he had 2 to 3 hours of work every day. So I always had cautioned him that it would be tough to sustain that, but well, that's good. Eight in one day. I don't know if I could do 8 interviews in 1 day.
It's not easy, Todd. I had to build up, just kind of like a marathon runner, and you can't just get out there and run 26 miles. I had to get myself up to that point. It took a little bit of time for sure, but you know, one thing I also will kind of say to that is doing the 8 in one single day. I mean, the buildup it takes to prep for an interview and then the right. breakdown it takes afterwards, I'm able to really lock all those down in one day and then just have the rest of the week to focus on the other things that make it a viable business. And also, you know, to the point where I'm able to now stay 30 to 40 episodes ahead. And I'm always 30 to 40 episodes ahead because unlike Andy's show, which is very time sensitive, right, it's today, right. he needs to have the latest. My shows are evergreen. I have people that listen to episode 100 right. and get just as much out as they will out of 600 because I have very scripted questions. I ask the exact same questions. It's the exact same flow. The only difference with my interviews are the stories that my guests tell.
Makes sense.
So, John, as you record all of these talks that you're doing in advance, what's your publishing schedule? I mean, how does that flow? Do you publish, you know, like 5 shows at one time, like on Mondays, or do you do that on Tuesdays, or is there some sort of cadence? And so are you like scheduling them out, right? So they come out, right. you know, kind of automatically?
Great question. So I've actually got into a really solid rhythm for the last year approximately. And this is how I operate. So I'll do 8 interviews every single Monday, and I'll always stay between 30 to 40 episodes ahead. So once a month, so once every 30 days, I have what's called my publishing and scheduling day. So that's 1 day a month. So I'm interviewing 4 days a month every Monday over the course of that month. And all I'm doing on those Mondays are recording those episodes, doing a quick edit. It takes me about 5 minutes in total to edit a 30-minute episode. So at the end of those 8 days, I have 8 recorded and edited episodes. And then 1 day a week, 1 day a month, Rob, what I'm doing is I'm actually going in, I'm splicing in my intros, my sponsorships, and my outros, uploading them to Libsyn and scheduling them out every day at 3:30 a.m. Eastern time for the next 30 days. So 1 day a month, I'm scheduling the next 30. So just a handful of days ago, I did that. I had my publishing month, which put me out until actually May 27th. So that gave me plenty of buffer to know that during May 7th and May 21st, when I'm in Europe, that my episodes are going live every day at 3:30. It's already on the schedule.
Awesome.
Yeah, we do a lot of, I know a lot of folks that do that scheduling. You know, you can do that right in WordPress too. You just pre-schedule the post and it goes up and it's live. The good thing about it is too, is depending on what platform you're using, you can keep the audio files private until publishing time because people, totally. people have a tendency to try to guess what the, and if you stand with a standard,
the file URL
yeah. Especially if you're doing a standard, a naming scheme, I guess, for better words. That's an interesting concept to do all your publishing in 1 day. I don't know. I guess, you know, for the shows I do, it has to come up immediately. But one thing I did key on that I like, and so many podcasters, I think, get wrapped around the axle with, is you said you spend 2 to 3 minutes editing. I love it because that's me too. 2 to 3 minutes editing, it's done. It's in the can. That's it. And matter of fact, I don't even have to splice in sponsors. Sponsors are spliced in right in the show. So that's it. And of course, the blog post for me takes longer than the than anything else because I write pretty extensive show notes. So
yeah, and Todd, to that point, one thing for the listeners, I think they'll find valuable that I found is really important when you're editing, and the reason why I was able to take it from where it used to take me a long time when I first started, because, you know, I was just understanding how to podcast and I was, you know, trying to be a perfectionist, which is always a mistake. So now it takes me that like 3 to 5 minutes per episode. because I only go in, Todd, to the transitions. So when I stop talking and the other person start talking, those are the only areas that I'm actually editing, that transition to the guest and then the transition back to me. Because I realize that sometimes those handoffs aren't exactly smooth, especially if one of my guests isn't that familiar with being behind a microphone. There's a lot of ums and ahs and stutters to get going, which can easily be just chopped when the person actually gets their thoughts together and can launch into something coherent. So by just focusing on the transitions and keeping everything else natural, I keep my edits, my editing time to less than 5 minutes per episode.
Yeah, I think a lot of people could learn a few things from that, because I think a lot of times the way, you know, really the statistic out there is, and it's something that's held true from really the beginning of the time, is that most content creators don't make it past, you know, really about show 7, about 50% of them quit. And there's other reasons for that too, but I think a big reason of it is sometimes folks get wrapped around the axle and wanting to spend too much time. You know, they get a 45-minute show and they spend 5 hours cutting it and becoming self-critical, and it just kills them. I'm a firm believer in the beginning, just record and go and live with it and do your best. You'll get better over time.
Yeah, and I think that there is kind of a gradient here, though. I think it depends on the skill of the podcaster and how good they are as a speaker, how much they, you know, should or need to or want to do that additional editing. And I think that that's certainly a factor. I mean, if you can do a show without any mistakes and things like that, I think it's fantastic. And I think you can kind of get by on that. But I think there are going to be a certain amount of podcasters out there that are perfectionists, and they want to have a show that goes out and maybe makes their guests sound the best that they can. So I think that there is kind of a gradient here, and each person needs to decide how much time that they have to commit to this. But I think in a general sense, I mean, John, you're exactly right. I mean, I've done a lot of, you know, editing of conversations and things like that. And after a while, you kind of get used to seeing what those waveforms look like. And you can kind of streamline that process.
It's so weird how I know what an looks like just by the waveform.
Exactly. But I
I want to speak to that real quick, Rob, because I think you're making a really great point. And that is, I get so much feedback from my guests that have been listening to Entrepreneur on Fire. And they say, John, I've really enjoyed being a part of your journey, hearing you at the beginning when you were this robotic, stilted, inexperienced, you know, to be blunt, poor broadcaster on it almost every sense, but seeing you every single week getting just a little bit better, having a little more confidence, you know, feeling a little more open to be yourself in these episodes, they enjoyed that part. So that would kind of be one of my takeaways I'd want the listeners to really be focused on, is that your listeners are looking to connect with you as the host just as much as looking to get great content. So you don't need to be perfect. And in fact, sometimes perfection will just distance yourself from those listeners. So if you can be a human, if you can leave in the mistakes as you're growing, they'll understand that and they'll resonate with you even more.
You know, one thing I found too is that I became a much better content creator after I started doing video, because I was forced to be better, because it's harder to, you know, to edit the video stuff. You just, if you make a mistake, it's there, it's done. You have to live with it. And just like this morning, last night I've been planning a rearrangement of the cameras in the studio, and you know, like an idiot, instead of having a couple of days, I started it last night, and, you know, I get in the studio this morning thinking everything's going to be good, and this camera is completely out of whack. You know, it's not the right, the color balance is off, even though I white balanced it, and it's, you know, you just make a small change, and then you're like, you have to redial things back in. So one thing I do recommend too to folks is don't move your stuff once you get it set up. but this was a long-term plan move. I just didn't get the camera right, but it is what it is. And you learn by those mistakes, you know?
Yeah. And I think this show is a good example of what can be done too, because, you know, both Todd and I have very busy schedules, and we don't do any prep for this show at all. We just get on it and do it live, and it's a live show, and what happens on this thing happens on this thing. So it's something that both Todd and I have just, you know, we just, that's just what we do, and And, you know, we've been around the space long enough to kind of just ad lib this thing. You know, there are a lot of podcasters that would probably do a show like this and it would be much more structured and all that stuff. But we do it because we want to have natural conversations with our guests and topics and be timely and, you know, think off the top, you know, off the top of our heads and really help people kind of get a behind the scenes view of what's going on in the podcasting space and kind of expand their spectrum of view of what parts of this space are coming and could have an impact. So anyway, I think it's an interesting conversation because I think a lot of podcasters do fade out and because I've done it myself. So I'm a perfect example. I did a show for 6 years that had heavy editing and heavy scripting and we just burned out of it actually.
You know, and the burnout thing is real. And you know, you said you're getting ready to head off for 2 weeks for vacation. And, you know, my first 5 years, the only break I took was 10 days when my dad died. And I didn't, you know, I mean, it was hardcore. And I was at the time only doing two shows, you know, two shows a week. And, unless I was real, you know, I shouldn't say didn't miss any, I may have missed a handful in, you know, like the first 5 years, but now I've learned, okay, if I'm going to miss a show, just tell the audience, I'm not going to stress it. I don't even worry about getting a guest host. It's, you know, and I just, as long as I tell them, hey, I'm going to be out, you know, it's not going to happen. And I've gotten to be able to, of course, I'm at my regular show, I'm at 945 episodes. So, you know, that, if the audience can't miss me for one, then so be it, right?
I think
there's plenty in there for them to listen to.
Please miss more. I'm trying to catch up on all these episodes. They just keep firing at me.
It's seven days a week. Don't worry. You're going to, you know, it's
so true.
Yeah, John, if you miss an episode, there's plenty for them to go in and listen to, right?
No, right, exactly. And it's kind of interesting because with iTunes, you actually have a 301 episode limit.
Right.
You have.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I've had to go in and create now three archive shows. It's the reason why there are three, it was my choice. I decided just to make a 100 episode archive show each time I get to that 100 point. So when I got to 401, I did a 1-to-100. And then every 100 step up, I'm doing that, which has actually been a really cool way for people to kind of come back and discover those newer episodes that they may have never gone way back to, but now it's up and new and noteworthy. They see the archives 2, the archives 3, and they want to go check them out. So it's kind of an interesting thing that I was forced to do. This has ended up pretty cool.
Yeah, for my content, you don't want to listen to episode 300. That was back when the iPhone 1 was introduced or something like that. So
yeah.
So it's really a non-starter. But you
it's
know,
like a history book, Todd. It's amazing.
Well, you know what? It is kind of funny though to go back and listen to earlier episodes because I just cringe and
oh yeah,
you know, it's like oh my god. But you know, it's amazing what we what we were able to accomplish even those early days is. As bad as it was, and I shouldn't say bad. It was just, you know, wasn't as refined. So, John, you know, part of your business too has let's save that for next. But I just want to ask one additional question about your guest. How do you where do you find 30 folks that are exciting enough to talk about each month? How do you find that many guests?
Last part of that sentence may be up for debate, so I'll just leave it at that. the reality is, and I'll take you through just a quick evolution of Entrepreneur on Fire with my guests. And so when I first started, I was like, how am I going to find guests? I went to a conference, Blog World, where I was able to meet some really great speakers, presenters, face-to-face, asked them to be on my show that hadn't even launched yet. Because I had that face-to-face, I got those first couple of yeses from the Pat Flynn, Amy Porterfield, Cliff Ravenscraft types. I was able to use those names as social proof as I was building up my launch of 40 podcasts in the bank before I did launch, which was really helpful. So when I launched, I've really kept that buffer. From that point forward, Todd, I was really looking at other conferences, entrepreneurial conferences around the world that are happening in multitudes every single month. For me, if somebody's speaking at a conference on an interesting topic, that means that they're probably a good speaker. They have some kind of authority in that niche and probably have an audience of some sort. So that was a great place to start. Also, industry magazines like Inc., Fast Company were great as well. I will say at the six-month point, I hit the tipping point where I actually started having more guests reach out to me than I could even have on my show. And as we sit right now in May of 2014, I get hundreds of inbound requests every single month to be a guest. And it's one of my VA's primary jobs to filter through those and to get me the 50 or so that I can look at to bring it down to 30 or so. So that tipping happened about at the 6 or 7 month point of the Entrepreneur Fire launch. And I have not reached out to probably more than 20 people personally since then.
All right, cool.
So, John, do you get a lot of book kind of publishers reaching out to you, public relations folks and things like that? Yeah.
Anybody that reaches out to me from the PR world, like that's representing somebody else, is something that my VA immediately knows to send a form response back. Absolutely not. It has to be a personal email from the entrepreneur who makes a reference to Entrepreneur on Fire, that has actually listened to the show, that knows the show, and that wants to contribute to the show's format. Like when I have people that email me and say, I'd be a great guest because I can talk about, you know, Pinterest and how Pinterest can make your business awesome. I'm like, well, you don't know my show then, because we don't talk about one social media platform and just how it can improve your business. We do a deep dive into the entrepreneur's journey. I take you back and make you tell us a failure and the lessons you learned from that time that you fell on your face. Then I make you tell us an aha moment and that aha moment you had. And then we bring it to something you're doing now, but not till the end. And so my VA knows to look out for people who actually try to connect with Entrepreneur on Fire in a genuine way, that know the show and are looking forward to bringing that kind of structure to the interview.
Now, yeah, because I know that there's mailing lists out there in the radio industry, and they're constantly, I mean, I still get those emails. And they're just like bulk emails that come in, and they're like authors that want to talk about, you know, some book on sexuality or, you know, personal relationships or things like that. And I still get those, and my show's been shut down since 2006. That just tells you how much, you know, I mean, really how much filtering that they do against those lists. And once you get on those lists, you don't come off.
It's so true. It's crazy. Well, Todd, my man, you have me for the next 13 minutes. I am yours. So whatever thing you want to talk about, I'm excited.
Sure. So, you know, one thing that I've seen on many entrepreneur shows that really, I mean, flat out just turn me off and make me want to hurl is it's largely this self promotion / oh my God, I'm so freaking wonderful. And and to be honest with you, having been a business owner of one sort or another for many, many years, when I hear people start talking hype, I turn off. And maybe I'm unique in that situation. And so in large part, I don't listen to entrepreneurial shows because they all follow largely the same format. And to be honest with you, I feel most of these people are fake. I don't get a lot of true value out of them. And now there's some exceptions to the rule, but oftentimes I'm very skeptical in claims and in the way people come across. I don't know, Rob, do you feel that same way, or what is your thoughts on some of the entrepreneur type shows?
Well, anyway, I just dropped on the video side. I'm going to have to call back in, I think.
Yeah, you're live here.
But I think that the shows are good for connecting with an audience that has an interest in learning. And I think, a lot of the shows do a good job of that, of sharing tips and tricks and things like that. So I think that there's a value to them. But I think that there is kind of a side to them, you know, where some of the shows are, you know, kind of walking an edge of credibility. So anyway, I'm going to call back.
Your video is still good on this side.
Oh, it is? Okay, yeah. I can't see you guys. So.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see Rob as well. He looks good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, now, all right. Now it went away. Now you're back.
Oh, okay. All right. Weird.
So another thing, you kind of, when I was, you know, when I'm on your site, and one thing that is very unusual for folks to do is to announce earnings claims on your website. And when I first came across your website, I'll be honest, John, it really turned me off. I'm kind of like, why are you bragging about how much money you're making? And I understand part of the reason why you're doing that, but I've worked with a lot of podcasters for many, many, many years. And to be honest with you, I'm skeptical on your numbers. And, you know, I don't know how to say it any other way, but it strikes strange that, you know, someone would, I know how much podcasters make. I don't ever tell anybody how much podcasters make. That's the business I'm in. And it just seems odd to me that you do that. Can you explain why you talk about how much money you make on your program?
Absolutely. So really my focus when I started Entrepreneur on Fire was to create an avatar. And for my opinion, what an avatar means to me and what I really try to teach others that are looking to do the same is that one perfect listener. So my perfect listener is Jimmy. You know, he's a guy that doesn't really know much about entrepreneurship, that doesn't know much about podcasting. To be honest, I could go into great depth about who Jimmy is, his life, his kids, his family. I won't, just for time purposes, but that's my avatar. Those are the listeners, and Jimmy specifically, and people like him, Todd, that I'm trying to reach. You, who I respect a lot in the industry, are definitely not my avatar. You're not somebody who I'm looking to have listen to Entrepreneur on Fire to get anything out of the content that I produce. I mean, you have been in this industry for a while. This is stuff that you know and already are very familiar with. So I really am a believer in focusing on your audience, knowing your audience, and serving them, not trying to serve everybody, not trying to please everybody.
Right.
So to get specific on the income reports, when I was still in the corporate world, I picked up podcasting as just a consumer and some person that I really grew to know, like, and trust very early on, well before my entrepreneurial leap, was Pat Flynn of Smart Passive Income. And I thought Pat was awesome for how genuine he came across. You know, when we were talking about being natural and not editing everything out of his podcast when he coughs or sneezes or makes a mistake, I love that about him. A lot of people do as well. And we're resonating with that. And one thing that I respected, I kind of had the opposite opinion of you when I got onto his site and saw his income report. I'm like, now here's a guy that is getting out there and is showing what's working for him in the smart passive income world. And I always enjoyed reading those reports and seeing A, what was working, and B, what wasn't. So Kate and myself here at Entrepreneur on Fire started having some financial success, which didn't really start to come in a big way until the 13-month mark of post-launch, which was actually the 16th-month mark of actually starting Entrepreneur on Fire as a business, I kind of just had this decision, this little aha moment of my own, saying, I want to do what Pat's doing for the smart passive income community for the podcasting industry. And by the podcasting industry, I mean people who are looking to get into podcasting for potentially the first time and don't know much about it. I want to show the successes that we're having so that these beginner podcasters could potentially emulate the successes and some of the things that we're doing right. But I also want to show all of our mistakes and failures that we're making, all the money that we're spending in the wrong areas, so they can avoid those mistakes, those wasted time, and those wasted efforts that we are consistently making on a monthly basis. And I'm happy that we're making on a monthly basis, because if we weren't making mistakes and failing every month, then we're not trying to break new ground and get into new areas. So I published the income report for that very specific reason. I totally understand anybody and everybody's, including your, skepticism about it. In fact, because of that knowledge and understanding, you know, being in corporate finance myself, I'm a numbers guy, I realize that. We've actually been having our certified financial planner verify every single number within our income report. He's right there at the top of our income reports where he introduces himself, links to his license, says, I'm a third-party certified CPA. This is what I do. This is, you know, me having access to John's, all of his income, all of his bank statements, everything. I'm verifying this report because I think that there is a need for that, Todd. There's a reason to be skeptical, and there's no reason to just accept things you see out there in the online world. And there's, frankly, a lot of reasons that back that up why you should not be accepting of things. And I'm not going to, you know, sit here and try to say, you know, I am, you know, should be trusted without any doubt, because that's not the case. Everybody should approach this from every angle they want to. I know that Kate and I work really hard every month to create as informative of an income report as we're able to. And we have a CPA that verifies that. And then we put the income report out to the world. And there's a lot of people that get value from it. And then there's a lot of people that are turned off by it. And again, those people that are turned off by it are not the people that I, John Lee Dumas, am trying to serve.
Right. And I, you know, I think the, you know, maybe I'm old school. And maybe that's the reason why it, for me personally, that it just, you know, kind of comes across weird to me. I guess that's for a better word. And I, you know, it's something, you know, I've talked to Rob before about this, you know, for, you know, Pat, what he does is great, but for being a passive income guy, he sure does one heck of a lot of active selling. There's nothing passive about passive income. That's, you know, that's kind of a misnomer, and no matter what anybody's going to say, it's not passive income. It's active income. You don't make that kind of income without being very actively engaged in promoting and pushing and selling and everything else that goes along with being in business.
Rob, I think that there's, but, you know,
Well, for those two weeks that I'm actually going to be in Europe, for instance, and not one time tuning in and not one time checking in with the business, every single day there'll be an episode that goes live that's generating $1,400 in sponsorship income for me. There'll be sales that are coming through on Podcasters Paradise, which is our community that we've created for podcasters to create, grow, and monetize your podcast. For Webinar on Fire, our product about webinars, these sales will be coming in without me actively working. Now, listen, this is just a two-week vacation. I mean, when somebody in corporate America takes a two-week vacation, they're still getting paid too. So, I mean, there is a total, you know, misnomer out there about passive income. And I agree with you on every level, Todd, that passive income is anything but passive, you know, until that day you truly do just sell it all or shut it all down and put it into annuity and let that money you've made start paying you out, or however you want to operate. But I work, you know, part of that income report is publishing my time that I work on a weekly basis via Rescue Time, which is an app that we use. And this month of, I work 7 days a week. Saturdays and Sundays I take it a little bit easier, but today, you know, I have 8 interviews on other shows, so I'm working pretty hard today. And I think that I did 267 hours of work in the month of April and came out to something like, you know, 75 or 80 hours per week. And that's with a 7-day week factored in, and 9 hours a day, again, 7 hours a week. So 7 days with a 7-day a week work plan. So this does not come with little effort. There's no 4-hour work week Tim Ferriss method from the Entrepreneur on Fire perspective. We work incredibly hard and we share that side of it too.
Yeah, I'm an 80-hour work week guy, maybe 90.
Yeah.
Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna mention to John's credit here it's important, I think, in the podcasting space in general here to have examples of people that are being successful in doing this. And I think that, you know, that's why it is so important, right, to be, you know, open and have this be verifiable somehow, so a person doesn't feel like that there's claims being made that are not realistic. And I know it's really has been a hot button issue in the podcasting space for a long time, because mm-hmm. people have wanted to earn an income and be self-employed and be, you know, be a John Dumas. And I think that that's, John is a great example of what is possible. And so is Cliff Ravenscraft and Pat Flynn and all these guys that are out there trying to help people and earn an income for themselves. But primarily building big communities. And I think that's what, you know, all those folks are good at. John, you're part of that mix, and I think there is a value there to the podcaster community and the greater world to have excited people out there that are talking about the space and trying to share how to build a personal business around this. Because I, you know, it's a big part of this that's kind of held podcasting back, is, and I think that's a big reason why we're seeing Pat Flynn's and the whole social media marketing side of this kind of grow and develop. It's all kind of parallel paths here, and I think I actually like it. I agree with Todd too that credibility is a big part of this mix. I mean, if there happens to be a person out there that's getting into the space and doing like what you're doing, John, but not transparent and open and honest like you are, then that can damage it for everybody.
You know, and I want people to be successful in the space. Don't get me wrong. You know, we want people to make money and to earn money.
Yep.
And I also want to be the purveyor of realistic expectations to podcasters too.
Sure.
That for the most part, unless they have a business that they are promoting and they have something that's tied to their show, where it actually is going to help grow their business and what they're doing. And if they have just a general run of the mill show that doesn't tie to a business, it's purely a volume play to basically get to the point where you're going to be able to make enough money with a sponsor. It truly is. It's volume and
scale. Yeah.
And yeah, you got to scale it. It can't be, if you have a show that has 1,000 listeners and it's not tied to any type of business or anything else, it don't matter how big that audience is, you're not going to make a lot of money.
Todd, and to your point, because you're completely right, you've been in this space for a long time, and I know where your skepticism comes from, because you haven't seen the kind of financial success that Entrepreneur on Fire seen in a very short period of time. But the reality
I've seen shows do very, very well and probably make in excess of what you made in your March report just having a regular show. That is completely possible. But, I've never seen a show be able to churn affiliate type deals into that type of revenue.
Right. And that is the point that I want to make, is that 78% of our income comes from non-podcasting related income, where our podcast is responsible for it, because that built the community. Like Rob said, the podcast allowed us to build this really passionate and loyal community that is the reason that we've been able to create products, services, have affiliate income non-related to the show, one-on-one mentoring, some masterminds I've created that account for the vast majority of the income of Entrepreneur on Fire, where the actual podcast specific revenue is small in comparison.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's just your vehicle to communicate with your community is what it is, and to get them excited and to add value to their lives. Yeah.
And I think it's important, because the comment I get back, because I get emails from people from time to time, what is the revenue potential of my show? And I don't want to beat a dead horse, unless it's tied to your business or it's tied to a third party service driving more people in, your revenue potential of your show is X based on your current audience size. And I think the majority, the high majority of shows out there are not entrepreneur type. They don't have extra services that go along with their show. They don't have a business tied to it, per se.
Well, Todd, I respect your skepticism and the manner in which you approached it.
When I see, I understand the end goal for you, and I'm sure your fan base likes to see those types of numbers, but for the average guy that's doing a show, it's very hard to tell them in the face that this is the potential that you can make, because there's very few John Lee Dumases out there, you know what I mean? And you're trying to replicate that.
I think that's a perfect way, Todd, to end the show. No, I'm just kidding. Unfortunately, I do, because of my schedule, I was supposed to cut off at 9:40 here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Pacific time. I would if sometime in the upcoming months, you'd be willing to have me back on.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back on and finish this conversation for sure.
I'd love to. And I appreciate you guys taking the time to have me on.
Thanks, John.
All right.
Take care, guys.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
I didn't piss him off, did I?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that they're all good questions that, I think there are honest answers for, and there are straightforward answers that, he's, I'm sure, prepared to answer, and he's thought about those issues as he's gone down this path. So, I mean, look, I think that there's a need for what John's doing out there, and he does do it in a way that has credibility, I think, and you know, and but it does kind of walk that line, right? I mean, those types of shows do kind of you know, appeal to folks that are looking for kind of a quick fix to becoming rich. And there's been a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of people or a lot of online TV people, you know, like I remember, you know, it's these late night, you know, TV infomercials that have been talking about, you know, buy this book and you can, you know, become a millionaire kind of thing. And I think it does kind of ride along that same, it's kind of trying to appeal to people that are looking for a get quick rich kind of, you know, approach. And the vast majority of people can't really pull that off, you know. And I think there's a danger there of setting expectations here, you know, really high, but the realities of what they can actually achieve is quite a bit lower. Yeah. But I guess if John or Pat Flynn or, you know, any of these guys can help those guys, you know, move up, you know, 10 or 20% on that scale, right, to get almost to their level, then it probably has some value in people's lives. But so it gets back to how that's done and how honest and transparent and how realistic it's portrayed too, right?
Yeah. And, you know, if all of a sudden, you know, the 100 of his clients start posting $100,000 income reports, then, you know, then they're on to something. But, you know, yeah. I know what performance of affiliate deals are in podcasting. I just know. Yeah. I've been doing this for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And
not everyone is going to be able to achieve a Pat Flynn or a John Lee Dumas kind of track record.
And did I pronounce his name wrong? Dumas? I said that right, right?
I'm assuming so. Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. And I've said it before. I just think posting income reports online is very tacky. That's me. That's just me, but I understand.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it is. I mean, I'm the same way. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that either. Yeah. But I can definitely see why he is doing it.
And right.
I think it's part of, you know, proving his case, right?
And his model.
Yeah, and making that case in a strong way that people will say, well, you know, John did it, and Pat Lynn and Cliff Ravenscraft has done it. Well, I can do it too. You know, it's trying to set a real example, right? And I think that those guys are doing the best they can to set that real example. But the question everybody has to get back to is, just because you join their membership organization or their training,
right,
that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to achieve their same level of success. So,
and I don't advertise it, but you know that I go and I do training from time to time. I had recently up in Seattle, and those clients, I don't get those clients because I talk about it. I get those clients because of word of mouth.
Yep.
You know, and I don't actively advertise, and be honest with you, those types of events, I don't even want to say this, but it's because it sounds cheesy. It adds a significant amount of income to my bottom line.
Yep.
You don't do a seminar for 110 business folks and spend a week, you know, doing that. So I understand where the potential is,
but Todd, I mean you could talk about it more than you do. Actually, I had to ask you a bunch of questions about it, I think, on the last episode to share anything about it.
And it just goes back to the way I've operated this entire time, you know, you know, anyone that and be honest with you, I spend I get a lot of business just cleaning up other knuckleheads' stuff.
Yeah.
You know, probably 50% of the calls that not just me but my team gets is, you know, we're going through and cleaning up some supposed consultants, you know, this disaster that they, any suggestions that they made for those shows. So, you know, so, and I'm not, and I have to be very careful because I don't want to, you know, I could very easily go and say, okay, today we just spent, you know, 8 hours on a webinar with a client cleaning up the mess that X company did. And that's just not cool. So I don't do that.
Yeah.
And,
but, well, in each, I mean, there's probably, I mean, even at those companies where there's failures, there's probably successes too. So there's a lot of factors that go into success and failure in this space too.
And sometimes it's a matchup of people too. It's not just,
So it's, you know, there's no, I don't believe there's one magic formula for success with this because it's a matching up of one's skills and a matching up of one's personality and presentation style and strategy and work ethic, you know, is a big part of anyone's success. In what is success really? I mean, is it always monetary? I don't know. I don't think it is.
So. No. You know, and you know, and I think too, and I've talked to you about this before, Rob, is that, you know, my skepticism is built on history. You know, and it's not, and this is just a straight podcasting thing. I get, you know, it doesn't happen so much anymore, but up to maybe 2 years ago, I would get a call from, you know, podcaster X, and he wants to get on ad deals, and I'm great, great, great. And let's get you up on the platform and let's get you measured and let's see where you're at. And, you know, they're, oh, I mean, I'm doing 85,000 listeners per episode. And, you know, I just smile and at that time and just say, okay, great, great, great. And let's get you up and get you online. And then the real number shows up. So, you know, when, and, oh, you mean I have to be measured? Oh, you mean I have to be verified? And got it, it's, you know, I used to, when I was in the Navy, I was in a squadron that made, was basically it was VQ1, and matter of fact, they were in the news a number of years ago landing one of their aircraft in China, and you can basically look up what that squadron did. But needless to say, we had this saying, "In God we trust, all others we monitor." That was the squadron's logo, our slogan.
Talk about skepticism.
Yeah. So, from an early day back in the early 80s, you know, I've had this mentality. Okay, tell me what you're going to tell me. But I'm going to verify. or monitor, or, you know, that. And of course, that's a kind of a sore subject these days with everything that's went on with the news recently. But, you know, it's, to me, it's, and maybe it's just in my DNA, you know, that I give a skeptical eye to everything. So,
well, I think that's a good or a bad thing. You've been on this planet for as long as we have. You've seen a lot of different things, and you've seen charlatans, and you've seen people that are authentic, and you can. It's pretty easy to detect those things.
And John's energy is, you know, it's contagious. He's a he's a likable guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah,
you know, and he, you know, and you can see where people would be wanting to, you know, talk with him and learn from him. Yes, it's understandable.
But I think he also thinks outside of the box too, and I think that's his biggest value prop from when I've. You know, just from our conversation today, I think you saw a glimpse of that. His thinking around how he produces his show.
Well, I think that's what he's doing for production is brilliant.
Yeah. So that's a little glimpse on how you know, guys like this, I think, add a lot of value to the space because they break the molds somewhat of conventional thinking. You know, and it just gets back to, you know, people have been around the space are going to be skeptical and are concerned about, you know, what the long-term view is here, you know, from guys like this out there doing what they're doing. And is it helping the space or is it hurting the space? And I think a lot of these guys are, you know, helping people, but they also have their failures too. I know that's been talked about a little bit on these shows, and I listened to some of these shows too. And they also talk, you know, on occasion about their failures, but but it is true. Most of the time they're talking about their big successes. So,
yeah. Yeah. And you know, you look at stuff that we've done and I look at what Raw Voice has done. You know, we launched our first, you know, now it's, I've got a, you know, great team of writers that are putting together articles over at podcasternews.com. And, you know, that was originally when we launched that site the first time. You know, that was supposed to be in like a local instantaneous news network. And that was an idea that we threw against the wall that didn't stick. It was, you know, actually, it probably would be a much better, much easier to get it to succeed now than we did back then. But,
yeah,
you know, that was, I would call that a learning experience. I guess that's what you call a failure.
Yeah, that's right.
And but yep. Then again, what it led to was, okay, we weren't thinking broad enough, and that's what led to, you know, the launch of blueberry.com and, you know, the building of the networks of ProMed and Travelcast and Tech Podcast, you know, that all surrounded kind of that learning moment from that website. But then again, today we come back and say, let's reutilize that property and, you know, make it a resource for podcasters to get information and access to content. And, you know, so it wasn't a wasted effort, but it took a while to come full circle.
Yeah, that's right.
So I was reading here in the chat room and one of the listeners said, John's income report motivates me. And then Podcast Coach says, I thought it went well. He's charging $2,000, not a typo, for 80 minutes of phone calls. So does that mean he's charging $2,000 for an 80 minute consulting session? He says that's $1,500 an hour. Source Duct Tape Marketing Podcast, a learning opportunity. Oh, that's another guy that's charging.
Oh, I see.
Maybe not John.
Yeah, that's not John. I didn't think that that's how John worked.
You know, and we're very straight on what our rates are. We, you know, when we're doing a phone conversation, it's $100 an hour.
Yeah.
And we're probably undercharging for that, but that's what we charge.
Yeah.
For phone conversations. And, you know, we do, and generally we can get everything done. We can get a lot done in an hour with a podcaster. Yeah. A lot. I mean, amount. Usually we take care of their problem or help them takes 20 minutes and then we spend 40 minutes with them on other stuff, refining and, so yeah.
Yeah, Todd, I just think, I mean, in the bigger picture things here, I mean, you just have a different business philosophy approach.
I do.
Yeah. And I think that's your credit too. I think there's a lot of credibility behind what you're, you know, how you go about your business. And I think that's totally a reflection of who you are and how you go about operating your business. And you're not a boastful person at all. So it would be against the grain to see you do that.
Well, I hope John makes $155,000 a month, you know, and if he does, you know, he's going to be in a position to buy some companies soon. You know? So, you know, you can do a couple of years of that. That's a pretty nice little nest egg, you know?
Yeah. You know, and I guess, you know, a big question for John is he investing back into the space too? I mean, you know, and trying to, and I think in some ways he is, he was accessible to us on this show and we are, this is a totally a volunteer effort on all of our part to do this show every Saturday. And it's not like, you know, I think that we drive so much value that we're, you know, worth making $100,000 a year, each one of us, for doing this.
Right.
This is just, we do it because we love the space and
yeah.
And want to share, you know, what's going on. That's my motivation anyway.
Dave does say in the chat room that John is charging $2,000 for 4 20-minute phone calls.
Oh, okay. Well.
Wow.
If
that's better than the top lawyers in New York.
Yeah. So is that Dave Jackson? Or?
Yeah, Dave Jackson's in the chat room.
Yeah.
So okay. you know it's let me just put this carefully. I have, of course, obviously Barry on my team is a lawyer, and he's, you know, practiced law for many, many years. And from time to time, we need to go outside the company for legal help. And sure. The company that we're dealing with now is a top firm in their class in Michigan. Their legal is nowhere near, I mean, what John is getting for consulting. You know, they're a top tier law firm, and I don't know. I don't think I could impair $2,000 worth of enlightened information in 80 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Could you give someone an I guess if people are willing to pay it.
You probably could if you plan it out and you create a very condensed presentation that is streamlined. We've both done some consulting together with podcasts. This is right. A long time ago, but and it can be done in a pretty brief period of time. The devil's in the details in this space, though. And I think that's, you know, I know Cliff Ravenscraft, he typically does much more long-term right. deals where right. he'll actually support, you know, an up-and-coming podcaster for many months.
Right, right, right.
And then talk to them in stages of progress.
Yeah.
And I think that's
a good
that's
model.
A better way.
Yeah, I think that's a great model. You know, and you check in on them and how you doing, what's going on, what's working. This is what I'm observing, you know, and that requires a time commitment on your part to also check. And that's, you know, part of doing consulting business, you know?
Yeah. I think that's his, podcasting A to Z, course that he right. does, where it's kind of like, the whole spectrum, right? You know, coming up with a concept and having it be something passionate of yours and getting excited about it and then working your way through all of the setups, you know, because there's a lot of technical setups, there's a lot of format setups, there's a lot of equipment setups and all these things you have to go through to really do that. And you know, like Cliff and others, they sell equipment and they sell, you know, training and they sell you know, getting hosting and then actual coaching them on presentation styles and helping them through those kind of things. So, I mean, if it's good training, it does have a value because, I mean, there's a lot of podcasters that start out that don't do that and they make a lot of mistakes in the beginning, just like, you know, I'm sure you and I did when we yeah. first started because there were no podcasting training back when we started. That you're starting from scratch. I mean, I walked into a radio station and did a show live. Never had any kind of radio background or broadcasting background and made a lot of mistakes,
right.
you know, at the beginning and just worked my way through it and struggled and ad-libbed and did what I had to do. I certainly wasn't, you know, I don't consider myself to be a professional broadcaster. I never really did. I just thought of myself as a guy that had a passion about a space and was in there talking about it.
The I was looking at his March income breakdown. His Podcaster Paradise made $111,000, which equals to about 93 podcasters paying $1,200.
Yep.
You know, I have a hard time getting podcasters to pay $20 for hosting.
yeah, you do kind of. I mean, it does raise that question, right? It's so, like, you know, these people are paying $2,000 or $1,200 to get this training. The question I have is, will they ever get any kind of return on that investment? Yeah.
So, and, so his yeah. next his sponsorship income was, let's see here, let me get the right number, was $40,000 was his sponsorship income. He had audiobooks, and I know how much audiobooks pays on a CPM level. Yeah. He doesn't say exactly how much they paid him. 99 Design. eVoice, FreshBooks, LegalZoom, Lynda.com, MailRoute, Indiegogo, and Squarespace. Those are, let me click on the audiobooks one. That one is, I don't know if he's doing their, don't know which, I don't know if he's doing their affiliate, if he's doing the pure sponsorship, but all these are pretty much, unless he's got special deals, these are all pretty much standard affiliate things. And he may not. He may have straight up sponsorships with Squarespace and audiobooks, but I also know exactly what those two pay. And Squarespace is not on the very high end on CPM. Let's see here. It's just an name, just Fire Nation Elite Mastermind, whatever that is. That is a, and these are, again, if you look at the, if you look at the websites, they're all just Fire Nation. I don't know what Fire Nation does. It's some sort of, I guess maybe this is the consulting part or something. Who knows?
Yeah, I think if you're looking at it, yeah, I can't see the video coming from you. I think that is his podcaster community that he has built up. I think he's got several hundred shows that he's worked with.
Gotcha. He's got Total Launch Package. Must be a complete podcasting package of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
What does that cost?
I mean,
that's $3,500 bucks for a total.
Yeah.
Total Launch Package.
I mean, Todd, you could do something similar to this, probably. I mean, you have probably a lot more knowledge in this space than even those guys have.
Rob, but, we've done some of that, and
no, I know, and no, but
that's
why I go.
I mean, really,
what I'm saying is putting it out there more. It just depends if you probably don't have time to do more of that type of stuff.
Well, I don't know. We give it away. We give away most of the stuff for free, you know.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
You know, we give this information away for free, so we don't charge for it. One-on-one mentoring, $6,000. And yeah, he doesn't break it down. He just says how much. And long story short, it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff here. And he's got expenses. What's interesting, though, is he didn't make very much money with Libsyn. He made... if he's sending people over to host, he only made $253 with Libsyn, which is,
so little money over there.
They pay quarterly, in reality, so
yeah.
And that, you know, that I think there would be a direct relationship, but you know, I hope it is. I hope he's making this kind of money. I really do.
So. Oh, I do too. I mean, and I think he probably is. I mean, it's not hard to think that a person like that can can probably recruit through their charisma and their own kind of success to people to sign up for a package. I know Cliff's doing it, and others are doing it and trying to help, but they're also earning a living for themselves as well.
Right.
So
I would feel guilty charging $1,200 to a podcaster for a podcasting package.
Well, I think it also depends on who you're selling the package to. I think what these guys are going after are people that are already pretty successful in their lives.
Yeah.
That have lots of resources, and $1,200 to those folks may not be much of a risk, you know.
That's true.
It just depends on the type of person that he's able to, you know, attract to his services. There's a lot of people out there that have a lot of money that would like to extend their presence and build a community around in a podcast to support it, and it may be worth $1,200 to them to get some coaching. You know?
Right. And you know what will happen. And I don't think I've seen any of this happen, is that the internet is very unforgiving too.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he's delivering a fantastic package and people are happy, then good. But if the second someone's dissatisfied, then there'll end up being something, you know, but I don't think I've seen any of that online. I haven't been looking for it at all, but.
Yeah. I haven't seen, you know, anybody, that's really said anything, you know, that's derogatory about any of these guys.
Yeah.
So I think that they do genuinely want to connect with their audiences,
I'm sure.
and they're their communities and drive as much value to them as they can. I mean, that's the perception that I have. I'm sure that there's some charlatans out there that we're not thinking of that aren't.
And
right?
You know, and the thing is, you know, and I know Platt Flynn has a huge following, and he's done some, you know, he's pretty aggressive in the stuff that he does. So it's why I always kind of laugh about the passive income stuff. It's
yeah. Well, it's a dream that, I mean, he's tapping into a dream that a lot of people have, you know, retirement income, and
you know,
I don't have to work anymore, but I can still earn an income. Yeah.
You know how I earn income as a passive income guy? This is a true story, and this is something that worked. You remember in the Dial One days?
When we had
to pick, for those of you that don't know what that means, it used to be you were stuck with AT&T. And that was your only long distance carrier. And for you to still have landlines. And then AT&T got broke up, and they were broke up into regional bells. Well, then you had to pick. This was in the maybe 90, somewhere around there. Yep. You had to pick.
I remember that. Sure.
You had to pick your long distance carrier, MCI, Sprint, AT&T, and a few others. Well, I sold MCI. And I did very well at it. I had guys on the street. We did really, really well. And it was an upfront cash. It was, the way I got paid, it was, and this is part of the reason why we set up Raw Voice's Blueberry affiliate program the way we did, was that I did all the work up front. I got the people signed up, got them on. I think I made $45 to $70 per account, depending how much they billed the first 3 months. So that was a pretty good, and I paid my guys on the streets, $15 a count. So for me, it was, I made 30 straight up just pure profit on every sale they made. And I didn't have to pay salary. These guys were just salesmen. It was fantastic. Then I earned 10% of their long distance bill for the life of their account. So I signed up tens of thousands of people on long distance. And for about 10 years, I earn 10% of their long distance bill every month.
Wow.
Now that was passive income.
Yeah, that's passive income. That was annuity is what it is.
That was 9 months of work, and I did that. That paid an incredible amount of money to me. So that was reasons why we did the Blueberry thing the way we did. We basically said, okay, we're going to give you the commission up front, and then based on the volume of total revenue that you bring us annually, we're going to give you a check at the end of the year. And it's going to go on perpetuity until that account goes offline. And matter of fact, we're about ready to, we just put our reporting up on the system, and we've had some great success already. Some guys have done very, very well. And some folks aren't moving very much at all. And actually, I guess some people have done nothing. But there's a full spectrum there of, number of sales. And we're well on track having one guy that's going to, or not one guy, I think three or four of the affiliates are already on track to get a pretty healthy bonus check at the end of the year. And we've only been going 45 or 50 days or something like that. So the affiliate stuff can work, but we wanted to make sure that the folks had incentive long-term to continue to promote the product. So I didn't want to turn this into a sales pitch.
And another proven way to get passive, income coming in is to become a seller of or a broker of insurance.
Right.
And I think there's been quite a few podcasters over the years that have come from that space. That were insurance people that had fairly flexible schedules and had a lot of passive income coming in from their kind of bonuses that come in from their existing accounts that then gave them time to
was Cliff to do insurance podcasting before?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So and I'll be, I'm straight up, I'm here in Hawaii, and even though I'm a podcaster full time, I get my military retirement. That check comes in every month.
Yep.
And that's 25 years earned. But at the same time, it's, living in Hawaii, it doesn't even cover my mortgage. So it's, I don't know. I feel better talking with John, what he would really, if he really wants to go one step and beyond, have someone completely independent of him verify that data. I think that would help too, but I think he's already figures he's got his financial planner that's helping him with this. He doesn't need anybody additionally.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually see that link before. I didn't actually see that guy's verification. I was actually trying to look for that. Yeah. But so what else is happening in space? You hear anything going on special this week?
Well, I think things are starting to heat up around the whole patent dispute thing. There's no question around that. I think we talked about that a little bit last week.
Yeah.
And I just think that the space keeps marching on, you know, and I think we may be coming into a period of a little bit of, I don't know. I feel some kind of reservation in the space somewhat around kind of podcasting platforms and what the kind of future of that is. I'm just speaking in general terms about podcasting platforms. I think that there's probably some changes coming soon that, and I'm speaking not anything that I'm necessarily associated with that's going to be the primary drivers of this, but the whole thing, you know, with Apple and what's happening there, I just get a sense that they're much more enthused about the space.
Well, that's good.
And I think, I'm going to be going up and spending some time with them next week, trying to learn a bit more about what their podcasting activities are and what their thoughts and plans are. And I'm going to ask a lot of probing questions and see what I can find out and also what I can share.
Right.
and what we'll see. I think Apple, if you look at what they're doing, it's going to be interesting to see what they can do for the space in the long run. You know, they are the elephant in the room. And oftentimes I think we, as the podcaster community, focus on, you know, other platforms. And I don't hear a lot of people talking about what's happening with Apple and what they're doing with podcasting anymore. I hear a lot more talk about, you know, what Stitcher is doing or what Swell's doing or what other outside platforms are doing. So, you know, one of the big things that I think is coming, you know, the whole CarPlay thing, you know, with Apple in the car. I think the jury's out a little bit about how much of an impact that will really have and how soon. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a good development. I still think that the vast majority of consumption, even in the car, is going to come via the phone for most people. But I think in the long run, I think that CarPlay and apps in the car will become a larger and larger piece of the podcast consumption area. I don't know what you think about all that, Todd.
Well, it's pretty obvious with my kids, you know, and yeah. I've got two with smartphones, one without. He's only 10, so he doesn't have a phone yet, but he does use my Android tablet in the car.
Yep.
You know, and I basically will sometimes just say, the word I use is snapshot, and my kids hate it because I say, what are you using? And I try to get a feel for, wrong camera. I get a feel for what they're using, and, you know, it's like some mornings it's Pandora. My daughter's listening to some podcast, so sometimes it's a podcast. You know, and it's basically they're on their mobile devices consuming stuff, and they're each doing their own thing. And basically in our car, the rule we have is the driver rules the radio. And, so whenever my daughter's in, she Bluetooths it to the car, and she drives me crazy with some music that she likes to listen to. And I bury my head in an app, while she's driving. So, I think it's obvious what's going on in the vehicles, and to anyone that has a family, you just know that, or what we're doing our own selves in the vehicle. I do find myself from time to time falling back to regular FM or AM dial, from time to time. I don't always. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, it's the exception instead of the norm because I'm just trying to, you know, I try to sample about 100 podcasts. Well, it used to be a week. I try to do 100 podcasts a month.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah, and some of them it's 10 minutes and like, oh, puke, let me move on.
Yeah.
And usually I'm not in the car alone. Here, we're always taking the kids somewhere and we've got a notebook in the car and basically they'll write the show name down and I'll dictate my notes about the show right then and there in the vehicle. And so that's kind of how I spend a lot of my time trying to sample content. It drives my kids crazy because some of the stuff they hate. I don't know. Apple's still they're still king. You know, they're delivering the majority, high majority of all the impressions, whether it be iTunes, mobile, iPad, iPhone. They're doing it. The Android folks have really missed out on the boat by not having. That's what I'm going to cover in my next article for Podtertainment. Is I'm going to not this next one, episode 3. I've written as a follow up to talking about the segmentation of how we can now see exactly how much of a file has been. If they've skewed forward to 5 minute mark and then listened for 15, we can see now exactly what they've accessed. And I talk about that process a little bit, but in episode 4, we're going to talk about, I'm going to go back and talk about mobile and what's happening in the mobile space as far as apps and who's leading and who's fell off and just to give a heartbeat and some of the challenges we have. One of the challenges we have is, even Libsyn, they do not send a user agent. So you can't tell their app. You can't, it is not recognizable from a podcast play. And I think they do that on purpose. I don't think they want us aggregating their app totals. But we've talked to a number of app developers and said, please, please, please set a user agent so that we can see, we can break your app out. And most of them have been pretty receptive to it. Well, at the same time, we've had a couple say, I'll think about it, and it drives us crazy because we'd like to be able to give mobile more recognition, but they're hurting themselves because we can't tell.
Yeah.
What they look like is iOS. So iOS is getting credit.
Yeah, well, I mean, because I'm sure they're using that API in the phone to actually play the podcast, right?
Still could set their user agent. The user agent still could be set, and we could be able to recognize that and say, oh, that's XNX podcast player. That's XNX, that's this player, not that player. And we've tried, really hard to be able to, we get the app and I say, okay, we'll have a, we call it a, basically, we have a testing platform and, I'll hit play, stop, fast forward, play, stop, and we'll go in and we'll immediately pull the log files up and we'll look at, how did that app, what did it do? What data did it send? Is there a fingerprint in there that we can detect to say this was this app? And sometimes you just can't. It looks like Android or it looks like iOS.
I mean there's a lot of kind of things like that going on in the space, and I know one thing I did want to mention about kind of like what we're doing at Podcast One and what you're starting to see around content from us is we're branching out. One thing that's really interesting about Podcast One is the focus that we have and the diversity of content that we're kind of trying to pull together, from YouTube stars that are doing a podcast. Actually, we launched a podcast called the Honey Badger's Badass Animal Podcast here this last week. And it's a guy that does funny animal YouTube videos that is doing an audio podcast for us. So he's basically taking that same personality and he has this kind of persona called, his name is Randall. I mean, that's not his real name, but
right.
But it's a you know, it's this persona that he has and this presentation that he has is very much, you know, it's an entertaining kind of dialogue. If you just go into YouTube and search Honey Badger Animal Podcast, or yeah, it's the Honey Badger Animal Show, Badass Animal Show or whatever, and you can kind of see what he does. He's doing that in a podcast, and it's really, really kind of interesting, that type of content, as opposed to what's traditionally done in podcasting. So that, and then, you know, celebrity podcasts, you know, from guys, you know, people in Hollywood and stuff, and trying to bring in a lot of big celebrities to do guest conversations and things like that is a big thing that we're doing also. It's just the kind of age range and demographic spread that we have, you know, like we have a show with Kathy Lee Giffords, who's a little bit older person, and all the way down to YouTube celebrities that are younger people. So you know, what we're doing is we're creating different kinds of content. It's like we kind of pioneered the whole WWE wrestling genre
right,
too,
right?
And trying to do that kind of content too. So we're trying to find other genres of content that can be pumped into the space. And I think it's also getting some notice from the radio side. And this topic came up a little bit this past week around how podcasting, with podcasting and radio today, radio shows are moving towards podcasting.
Right.
More and more, and I think we're seeing that happen. You know, I talk to broadcasters all the time that they have a show, you know, that's doing well. You know, how can we take it out? And I know you're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And I know a bunch of other folks are doing that too, right now, trying to help the broadcasters, the broadcast radio folks, make this jump. But at some point, we're going to move down that line, and those folks are going to jump over to podcasting. But at some point, those radio guys are going to say, there's some terrific original podcasts. How do we get them on broadcast, yeah, right? So it feels like we're kind of early in that transition. But that topic has come up a few times. You know, I know Mark Ramsey, who came on this show not too long ago, talking about how talent in the podcasting space could be recruited by radio. But in order for that to really happen, I think formats need to get shorter, because traditionally in broadcast radio, you have like 2 or 3 hour shows. But making that jump to podcasting with a 3 hour daily show doesn't really work as well as I think it should, right? It needs to be shorter content because people listen to the whole thing. You know, these 3 hour blocks of radio shows are for people tuning in and out, right, in and out, in and out.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different kind of mentality. So the radio industry, I think over the long run, is going to have to transition their model from these 3 hour, 2 hour time blocks to just 1 hour.
But on a 3 hour show, they usually repeat the same content every hour. Some of the stuff gets repeated because they know that people are commuting, they've turned off, and they have a new audience an hour later. So
yeah, I mean, it's this tune in and tune out thing, but you know, a lot of these radio shows are putting out the same content as a podcast.
Right.
And they're putting out 2 to 3 hours. I mean, not complete hours. You know, a lot of the ads are cut out. So they're actually like 40 to 45 minute shows.
You want to talk about a mess. This is where the majority of our business has been here recently, is that, and as I told, I don't know if I said it publicly on the show or not, but we had a huge, huge, huge influx of radio companies talking with us, and I mean an incredible amount, almost to the point of saturation.
Yeah.
And we're looking at their infrastructure, and you want to talk about having been misguided from the beginning. There are some of these folks that went to their radio developers and say, hey, we want to add podcasting, and they threw and slopped in these solutions that they paid incredible amount of money for that are junk. I mean, absolutely trash junk. I mean, very, very bad.
Yep.
So, you know, it's like, okay, we can fix this for you. And you know, when we give them a price, oftentimes that shocks them to the core, because we're probably you know, a tenth or two tenths of the cost that they paid to do the original solution. And, but, you know, they are definitely, it's amazing what has been slopped together on, and not necessarily like Clear or some of those folks or NPR that, you know, they're pretty well dialed in, but it's these independent stations that are in all these markets. We had one radio station I looked at in, it was actually a Michigan radio station, independent in a pretty big market. Their feeds were like, they wouldn't even have been, the iTunes couldn't even took them. You know, it was that sloppy of implementation. So you're going to see a lot of cleanup from a technical side, and you're going to see them, because now the advertisers are like, the radio buyers are also buying the podcast. So they say, okay, we want the radio and the podcast. And the guys are like, but you have to measure. And so that's, you know, where we're, it's a good thing for us. You know, I can't complain.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot, I mean, a lot of these stations and these broadcast groups are wrestling with the concept of national versus local.
Right.
And I think that really cuts to the chase of their issue and why podcasting has been kind of not a focus for them for a very long time, is that they have sales organizations that are very local, and their infrastructure for distribution is primarily focused on local.
Yeah.
And they don't really think of the podcast as a first place distribution. It's almost like, you know, their tendency sometimes is just put out, you know, samples of the content.
And we've had some shockers already. We, you know, we've very quickly got a couple of companies up online with an easy to implement solution. And I'm like, you know, you've got a, you know, 15% of your audience is coming out of Europe. And they're like, what? You know, and you know, you know, as you get that reaction, you know, and, you know, I'm like, well, you got people that are all over the country that want to listen to the hometown radio. And that's why I think our Heart Radio has been pretty popular, too. Of course, they're not providing any feedback on their advertising the living piss out of it. But I just have no idea what type of traction they're getting.
Yeah. No, I mean, a lot of these broadcast radio guys are, they're just trying to get a handle on, you know, trying to do this local versus national thing.
Right.
You know, you throw into the mix global and it's like makes their head spin.
Yeah.
They don't really know how to monetize that. And then they don't really, you know, it's a whole nother level of consideration. And for a lot of the shows that these radio groups are producing, they are very local. The content is very specific to those markets.
Yep.
They usually have like maybe 10 or 20% of their collective shows that they want a podcast that could appeal to a national audience, and the rest of them would probably never appeal to a national audience.
I think I was shocked by the number of shows that these stations have. You know, some of them have. And then
if you think about it, they're running a 24/7 radio station. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like cable news, right? You know, the content quality is not always great on cable news. It's because they have to come up with something, to fill the airtime.
And another thing too that's is a challenge is that, and this is something we ran into with one station, is okay, so they have national syndication on many of these stations as well. So the national syndication is allowing, why the national syndicators got to get their act together, but the national syndicators are allowing them to take that audio feed that came over syndication and put that up on their website as a podcast. So here you've got, okay, let's use Mark Ramsey. You got the Mark Ramsey show that's sitting as a podcast on a local radio station's network that's being downloaded and listened to people, but not providing any metrics back to Mark Ramsey.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know how that's happening. I mean, it just shows that there's not a cohesive strategy on the part of the show to make sure that the affiliates are getting, you know, like players that they can embed on their website that pull off of the master podcast.
Right. Right.
And that's what Podcast One has. We have our own kind of web players that we share with our affiliates, and our shows that have their own sites.
Right.
That will pull all the content directly off of the master show feed or source, so you can aggregate all those numbers. Right. And I know that that's what your platform does as well.
Yeah. And it's just, and then you've got, you know, multiple parties. Everyone has a different platform. And, you know, so they're all working it. So it can become an integration. Well, that's when it gets expensive.
Yeah. And I think that these issues are getting sorted out by these radio groups and these radio stations. But it's going to take a couple of years for these guys to get all this stuff figured out and sorted out and have a sales strategy. I mean, I'm sure you're going to keep getting phone calls because a lot of these guys are going to want to monetize their national slash global shows that they have built up.
Well, that's what drove the calls, is that the buyers are telling them, you shall be on this system to measure, and they're having no choice. The media buyer directed them to be, because they're basically, that's what's happening, is the media buyers are saying, I won't go into any more details, but they're being forced.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but it's an interesting time. So we'll see what happens with the radio guys. And I think the podcasters are just going to have to continue up their game, though. They're going to have to, you know, that they need to realize that these multi-billion-dollar corporations, they don't want to lose their market share. And they're going to play hardball to keep their market share. And if that means moving into the digital space, that's where they're going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they may have had their heads in the sands for a while. I don't think they've got their heads in the sand anymore.
No, I think I agree 100% based on what I'm seeing in the area. You know, Podcast One is very much kind of like in the middle of this world of transition. And I think I agree 100%. I think that the broadcast guys are... The lion has been totally, you know, woken up.
Yeah.
It's just how fast is that lion gonna start eating up the space is the question.
Right.
And I don't know that it will. I mean, it may take a chunk of it.
Rob, we're at an hour and a half.
I know. Time has just run by.
I wish we could have spent more time with John, but he's a busy guy. So I thought we had him for 45 minutes. I didn't know we had him for 40. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's good to maybe have a show that has a guest on, and then you and I can just rant for a while. I think that's always good too. I mean, I think, you know, our numbers show that sometimes our better shows are the ones that you and I are just talking. Yeah.
Hey, just to give you an update too, I don't know if last week we were on the updated infrastructure or not, but the website is on some new infrastructure or updated infrastructure, reorganized infrastructure. And we ran into a problem. We essentially, some caching stuff wasn't working the way it was supposed to. So we had to remove the caching stuff on Geek News Central until we figured out where the bug is, and then we'll turn it back on. So we lost a little bit of speed here yesterday. Glad we caught it, because it was a pretty big issue. It was making some pages not update. It was just, you know, something that we implemented wrong on our site. So we're working on that. Template is continues to make progress. I'm hoping, crossing fingers, in 2 weeks, about 2 weeks from now, we might be able to start making the final switch over. And that's being very aggressive and hoping that we're going to make that 2 week deadline. I told the guys I want the new template up, and I want each site to have its own landing page within the next 2 weeks. Our biggest challenge, we've had to write scripting to take, for example, the new media show and pull the new media show data out and move it into the multi-user site.
Yep.
And basically then, because it's coming out of the Geek News Central site, being right into the new media show site, we got to write redirects for all that content so that anything that we've gained in Google will be pushed over to the new page. You know, and you're talking... I'm doing this for the Gadget Professor. I'm doing this for Robot Underpants, Chrome Show. So you're taking literally 100 or 200 blog posts out of Geek News Central and dropping it into those other sites.
Yep.
that, and I, that's the last step. I can't do that. Well, at some point I will go into a, I guess for a better word, I'll tell the bloggers, take it easy for a few days.
Yeah. Don't add to the complexity of our project.
Don't
right?
add
yeah.
a lot of content, and yeah. we're going to make this, we'll set up a beta site and we'll chunk it over.
Yeah.
And yeah. then pray it all works when it comes together. This has been a pretty big undertaking to make this happen, but I'll be really pleased when it's finished, and it should carry us for, I'm hoping for the next, 3 or 4 years at least in design work. But
so how robust is the whole WordPress multi-site capability?
Oh, it's incredible.
Really?
Yeah, it really is. It takes a little more resource to run multi-site, but it's pretty robust. The tools aren't bad from that standpoint. I don't know. I know that. I don't know how far it will scale. I don't know how many sites you could have on a specific server. We're thinking with the way we're implementing everything, it'll be a lot. Largely.
I mean, does the license have a limit to how many sites?
No, not at all. And sometimes, what it largely is database optimization. You know, like right now in Geek News Central, the database is no longer on the same server as the website. The database is off somewhere else.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And next thing, anyway, I don't want to get into too many details, but it's
sure.
And we're learning some tricks at the same time and doing this, so it's good, but we'll see where it leads. All right.
Yeah. All right. Well,
Dave, thanks for hanging out the whole time in the chat room, man. We've adding to the commentary in there.
Well, it's because Dave's going to be on the show next week.
Oh yeah, that's right. Dave is.
Yeah.
So we'll have fun. I won't beat you up too bad, Dave. Promise.
Dave's a good guy.
Yes, he is. Hey, folks. Todd@newmediashow.com or Rob@newmediashow.com. We've gotten some requests in for people that want to be guests. And here's really the deal. Is if you want to be a guest, I really need you to tell me why we should have you. And you need to listen to a few episodes as well to get a feel of what we talk here at a very high level. So, and also down in the weeds at some point too. So if you want to be a guest, you need to kind of help us out with understanding exactly what you bring to the table.
Yeah. And, I should also say that Dave is Dave Jackson, the School of Podcasting.
Yep.
He's going to be on the show next week. It's another show about podcasting next week. So I don't know if we want to branch out and get into other areas of new media. I can maybe kind of push into some other areas. I know at one point we were talking about having a podcast buyer on the show, but
yeah.
I don't know if any of them want to speak publicly about what they do. But we'll see.
I mean, I've talked one media buyer into coming to Podcast Movement, and he's going to come and going to speak. It's basically going to be kind of a two panel type thing, or maybe three of us. The other guy that I've asked to come on, he has not responded to my. It's the guy I work with a lot, and he. I think he's having to run it up the food chain to find out if he's going to have permission to come on or not. So that I can understand their reluctancy to
sure, some, you I know, can too.
Yeah,
okay. But it is a. I mean, it is kind of pulling back the curtain on an aspect of this business that I don't think anybody's really gone there.
Right, and in another thing too is we guard our media buyers' names and contacts pretty religiously, largely because, I work with a network of people, and if someone says, I'll just contact that guy myself, I don't need Todd anymore.
Yeah. No, that's true.
And there goes my business model.
I know, Todd, I know what we should do. We should try and find somebody that's a former podcast buyer.
I know. I know a guy with another company. See if I can get him on. He may come on.
Yeah, because I mean, if it's a guy that's not actively doing it today,
yeah,
he might be more willing to talk frankly about it as well.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Yeah. Very cool. All right, everybody. Thanks for being here. And I hope you enjoyed the show. Send your comments, Todd or Rob at newmediashow.com. And we'd love to hear your feedback. Thanks for being here. Rob, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Todd.
To the audience, everyone, see you later next
time. Thank you. Bye.
Aloha.